This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. It is Wednesday, January the 30th. Thank you so much for tuning in today. First and foremost, I want to give a shout out to the patrons of the show. Sarah, thank you for being a patron. Helen, thank you for being a patron. Arnie, thank you for being a patron. Barbara and Kim, thank you for being patrons, supporters of the show. If you don't know what Patreon is, you can go to patreon.com/ the Mind and Fitness Podcast. Patreon is a place for content creators, people that have YouTube shows, podcasts, anything artistic, really. And it's really to further support the show. There's some additional value add items that can be incorporated into it as well. But it's a really great place basically to keep the lights on. This podcast takes an enormous amount of time, energy, funding, right, to get the equipment and being able to publish it and have a host site and all that kind of stuff. So first of all, thanks to them. The other way that you can support this show is if you're listening on an iDevice, so iPhone, iPad, iPod, is that still a thing? MacBook, whatever it is, just going over to iTunes and leaving a review. Five-star review, tap write a review if you really like what it is that you hear. Really helps get more exposure to the podcast. And then obviously, you know, tell a friend, tell a couple of friends, spread the message far and wide. This podcast is listened to in about 70 different countries around the world every single month, and we take a tremendous amount of pride in that. So today we are going to have a awesome interview with a physician. Elisa Batson is going to be on the show. And I'm going to be interviewing her about a variety of things, but we're going to talk about her chronic pain journey. We're also going to talk a lot about food allergies and intolerances. And of the hour and 5 or so minute conversation, that's really one of the bigger pieces that I took out of this, was this the whole idea of food sensitivities and food allergies, because you've heard me talk about it on the show, but I overcame years of problems with dairy to where I'd given it up entirely because it got so bad back in 2013. And we talk a little bit more in depth about that on the show. But if you're somebody that has been challenged with different food sensitivities, in fact, one of the great quotes in here that Dr. Batson says is that other than the instance of celiac disease, somewhere over 90% of food intolerances and food allergies are no more than BS, BS TMS, if you will. So really cool to hear somebody in the field actually talk about that kind of stuff. So she is trained in psychiatry. She is also trained in internal medicine, and she practices out of Nashville, Tennessee. So I'll link to her website and all that kind of stuff in the show notes so you can find some information about her if you want. She first came across TMS and mind-body syndrome and such by coming across Dr. Schubiner's work, and then eventually worked with somebody at the Pain Psychology Center in Beverly Hills. So it's awesome to get that kind of perspective. Before we get into that, I wanted to just touch base really quickly. One of the things I got asked recently, and actually I get it asked, it's asked of me quite a bit, but this whole idea of eliminating, like a necessity to eliminate stress in order to eliminate symptoms. And stress is always going to be a part of our lives, ladies and gentlemen that are listening to this podcast. As a matter of fact, right now in my personal life, I am probably dealing with as stressful of a situation perceived by any other person that'd be going through it as there could be. Aside from major health issues, this is family, work-related kind of thing. And it's among one of the more difficult times that I have faced in a long time. And with that being said, I don't have any physical symptoms. I actually just ate drank a big giant glass of milk, right? An adult drinking a glass of milk, but it's good. And I had cheese this morning and yogurt this morning, and there's just no problems, no food intolerances. I went and I lifted today and all that good stuff. So ultimately, it's the removing of the fear, and we're going to talk a lot about that kind of stuff as we work through this with Dr. Batson. So I hope that you enjoy the interview. Thank you so much for all the support. It really does mean the world when people spend an hour with me every single week and get a lot out of this show. So my ultimate hope is that the message of chronic pain being more of a psychological issue than any kind of a physical issue needs to be spread far and wide. Dr. Sarno would say that TMS hurts worse than anything that he was aware of in modern medicine or in medicine, period. So I think it's really important to make sure that you're underscoring a lot of this messaging. And regardless of how shitty it feels or how much it hurts or whatever the case is, the answer isn't always in the imaging. The answer isn't always in the bulge disc. It's not the herniated disc. you know, chronic pain lies much deeper than that. So hope you enjoy this interview. Feel free to DM me if you want. I'm getting a lot of messages from people all over the world, much more frequently now than even just a couple of months ago. And I love hearing from everybody. I put a call out there to people for recovery stories. I've got a couple that are sitting in the hopper, just ready to be listened to. And then I've got some emails that I need to respond to from people that that are offering up their story. So I promise that I will get to you shortly. Thank you again for reaching out. So without further ado, this is Dr. Batson. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein. I come to you today. I'm recording this from I'm with Dr. Alicia Batson, who is calling out of Nashville, Tennessee. How are you doing today?
Hi, Eddie. I'm doing great. It's great to talk to you.
Yeah, you as well. So I came across your story. I'm sort of surprised that I hadn't come across your name before. I'm so happy that I did. I found your story initially on the TMS Wiki, the success story section, and I started reading it, and it's just, and I'll link it in the show notes so people can go on and see it, you know, if they want to. But the list of symptoms just goes on and on and on, and it's rare to find an MD, a medical doctor that not only has gone through a lot of these things, but is, you know, is vulnerable enough to admit that they've gone through a lot of these things and be able to link it to something that's not physical. So first of all, let me just applaud you on that, because I think a lot of us that are probably listening to this have met some stubborn doctors over the years in one way or another. But kick us off and get us started. Like, what got you into medicine to begin with, and then we'll kind of transition into, you know, when did this pain stuff start for you?
Sure. So I had always wanted to be a doctor. That had just been always forefront in my mind and my planning. My father was a physician, and that just always seemed to be my path. And when I was in medical school and deciding what type of doctor I wanted to be, I decided I want to be a psychiatrist, but ultimately in residency ended up doing a combined internal medicine and psychiatry program. So by the end of my training, I was dual trained and became double boarded in internal medicine and general psychiatry. And the irony of that is that one would think that being trained in both internal medicine and psychiatry, I should have known that the brain can actually cause real pain in the body and other physical symptoms. But in fact, I did not know. And the reason I didn't know, and many other physicians don't know, is that we aren't taught this. This is not part of the training. And so it never occurred to me when I was going through my chronic pain symptoms that this was a possibility. So my symptoms began about 2 months into my first job outside of residency. It was a high-stress job. It was my first job. And, of course, there are certain stressors that go along with that for any physician. There were other stressful factors in my life, having moved, family stressors. And apparently all this culminated in one day at work having a sharp shooting pain shoot through my left elbow. And a month later, the exact same symptom occurred on my right elbow. These symptoms progressed down my forearm, into my hands, and ultimately I was diagnosed with repetitive strain injury, thought to be due to computer usage. And this was in the early 1990s. My private practice, my practice that I was in at a university was the beta, the beta test office for computer usage and electronic medical records. At the same time, they were creating their own program. So it was very caveman-like back then. We were having to type a lot. The programs didn't work. And so I was on the computer every night till midnight, waking up at, you know, early the next morning, getting back on the computer. And, you know, there was a lot of internal rage at how much time I was spending on the computer instead of taking care of patients. And so it was in that setting that these symptoms developed.
It's interesting that you mentioned the, you know, all the internal rage. I guess, like, that obviously wasn't something that came to you, I imagine, initially. You probably just thought, I've got the worst luck in the world, I would guess.
Absolutely. You know, I thought, wow, you know, it's these computers. It's because I'm typing so much, and this isn't normal. And of course, that's what I was being told by my medical care providers as well, that it was a computer injury. And so I believed that. However, none of my testing, my CAT scans of my neck, MRIs, EMG nerve conduction studies, blood work, everything, of course, was normal. And of course, that didn't rule out repetitive strain injury. In their view, it made it more likely. So these symptoms eventually caused me to have to quit work, because at this time, and you know, even currently, it was just about impossible to function in a job setting without interacting with a computer.
Right.
That was certainly a time when the voice recognition technology had not been fully developed and was not being used either.
Yes, I mean, I'm trying to think of what life would be like. I mean, it's tough now to imagine, but what life would be like. I was watching this documentary, this CNN documentary on the 90s, and it was all about technology and sort of the rise of computers in the 1990s. And I can't even imagine a world before that.
Right.
when all that stuff was around.
Right.
So one thing that I've always been curious about, I think the same thing about, like, you know, do tattoo artists, do they ever tattoo themselves? They always go and get someone else. How do they find that person? I think the same thing about doctors. So, like, you you know, you've gone through the residency, you start having these symptoms, and you find somebody else essentially to diagnose you. Was there ever a part of you that was like being told that you had this thing, but just based on what you knew about the body and even the mind at the time, like, was there a shed of doubt inside of you that was like, I don't know if this RSI thing really makes, I don't know if this makes sense to me?
Well, in the beginning, it made total sense because my symptoms were confined to my forearms. But as with most chronic pain patients, over time, the symptoms began to spread around my body. I ultimately developed over 30 different symptoms in my legs, my hips. I had severe hyperacusis, which is sound sensitivity. I developed food sensitivities. The list just goes on and on. And of course, by this time, when I had all these symptoms and they kept coming and going and spreading and worsening and getting better, at that point in time, I honestly still never suspected that these symptoms were somehow related to my internal emotional state or to any stressors in my life. I just felt like I must have some very unusual, rare disease that physicians just had not diagnosed yet. And like most chronic pain patients, you know, that sets you out on an odyssey of trying to figure out how to get better. So I started out in the conventional medical world, but I realized, having been a physician, I realized pretty quickly once my testing came back normal, and I wasn't able to get back to work, that I was going to start to be labeled this chronic pain patient. And there's a certain amount of prejudice within the medical community, at least there was in the 1990s, regarding these patients. Physicians feel helpless. They want to help the patient. They have no idea how. You know, when the testing comes back normal, they don't know what to do or what to say. And they can begin to dread seeing you, actually. And of course, you're always in a state of emotional desperation because you're in pain and no one has answers. So it becomes a very frustrating process to continue to interact with the medical community. So I pretty quickly left that community. I knew on a gut level that they had nothing to offer me. And I began an odyssey through the alternative medicine community. And that was a whole different journey, but no less, no more productive than the conventional medical world. I probably had every alternative medical treatment you can imagine multiple times over. I spent tens of thousands of dollars out of pocket on these treatments. You know, anything from physical therapies, somatic therapies, deep tissue massage, hundreds of massages that went. I traveled to a physical therapist in a different state and stayed there for 4 months getting deep tissue massage. I tried everything and nothing ever got it better more than probably 10 to 20%. There was never any significant improvement that was going to allow me to get back to work and lead the life I had led. And of course that was very, very, discouraging. You know, but fundamentally I really never gave up. I always felt like there has to be something going on. I just haven't figured it out yet because I knew my symptoms were real. I knew they weren't imagined. And even when the last neurologist I saw while he was leaving the office and his hand was on the door, he turned around and he said, "I think it's all in your head." And of course, he meant that in a way that was not meaning due to learned neural pathways in the brain.
Yeah.
Then I still knew that, look, I'm not imagining this. This is real. Something's going on, and I'm not one to give up. So I kept trying.
What about, because when I'm looking at the list, like one of the things that you went and did as a treatment was non-TMS psychotherapy and EMDR. And I'm really curious about, because before we started recording, I told you about how I went and saw a sports psychologist. I didn't end up working with him, but I did work with another psychologist who was CBT trained. However, he had read all of Sarno's books, knew all about him, and he knew exactly where I was coming from. So we didn't do techniques that I think TMS psychologists do. However, he knew the origins of my problems. He was trying to identify those kinds of things. So it was nice just to get that kind of empathy and even just to have somebody to talk to once a week. You know what I mean?
Right.
Tell me about your experience with non-TMS psychotherapy and EMDR.
Sure. So, you know, once you get far enough down the road of chronic pain, it's normal to start develop frustration, low mood. Certainly anxiety often goes hand in hand with chronic pain. And so many people ultimately end up in a therapist office. I had a very good therapist. He was very well respected and renowned in our community. I spent 2 years with him. And during that time, he did some EMDR, not a lot because I didn't feel it helpful. But I did stay with him for 2 years. And unfortunately, during that time, I didn't get any better at all. Now that I understand what causes chronic pain, it makes sense to me that I didn't get better, because he also did not have an understanding of what was causing the pain. And he wasn't able to tell me that this is coming from your brain. This is due to learned neural pathways. This is triggered by stressors in your past and current life. Or, you know, certain thoughts or emotions or conditioned responses. He didn't have that knowledge or the language around that knowledge to be able to convey that to me. He did suggest that my pain might get worse with worsening stress or if my mood is angry or upset or depressed. But honestly, I had pain all the time and I really couldn't see that correlation. At the same time, when that was suggested that perhaps my mood could make my symptoms worse, I really felt that I didn't really care if my mood made my symptoms worse because I was looking for the answer to why I was having symptoms at all. So I didn't care if my periodic emotions would cause my symptoms to fluctuate. That wasn't relevant to me. What was important to me was finding out what was causing the symptoms, getting to the answer, resolving it, and getting my life back.
Talk about, I want to jump into where it was, you know, where the moment was that everything kind of turned and you discovered what the answer was and how you got there. But one thing I have some general curiosity about, especially because I know that there's a listener who has pinged me a couple of times about food sensitivities. And I had told her, cause she was asking me about like a success story on somebody who had food sensitivities, but was able to resolve them. And I was like, well, me, because I kicked this dairy problem. And she had said, what about people that have to get down to extremely limited diets? And that's something that you specifically have talked mm-hmm. about. Your diet became almost impossible. You were sensitive to 13 different foods. So what are some of those 13 different foods? And then I want to get into how it was that you ultimately found what the root problem was.
Sure. So, so when I was trained as a physician, we are taught that you should never do food sensitivity testing on anyone because the testing is so inaccurate. It's nonspecific, and it doesn't reflect known scientific information about what we know about the body, what we know about antibodies against foods. It's just inaccurate and leads to more false positives than anything else. But despite this knowledge, despite a little voice telling me not to go get food sensitivity testing, in my state of desperation, I thought, well, maybe that's wrong information. Maybe I'm missing something. I really need to uncover every stone. So I did get food sensitivity testing, and lo and behold, of course, it came back with 13 different food sensitivities, and they were very broad. They ranged from, of course, the standard of dairy, eggs, and wheat, to things like different types of oils, like sesame oil or vinegar, or certain vegetables. So all these things that you would never even have considered could cause any food sensitivity. and when I began to try to take these things out of my diet, I was left with a very restricted diet, and not just a restricted diet, but it certainly affected my ability to go out and socialize with my friends, to go to restaurants, to go eat at their house, to have people over. And eating became a great source of anxiety and fear, which of course is the pattern. Pain begets fear, begets more pain. And so I have a great story about about eating eggs during this time that I'd like to share with you, because I think it just exemplifies so well how powerful the mind is to create real physical symptoms in the body.
Yeah, absolutely.
If it believes that it should, if it believes that you're in danger. So during the time I was beginning my full recovery from chronic pain with a TMS-trained therapist, I had begun to get better. I had made some headway. I still had a lot of fears around food and wondering if, you know, should I eat that? Should I eat this? I wasn't fully confident to just go out and eat anything yet. And so one day I realized that I had literally 2 minutes before my therapy session, my Skype therapy session with my therapist. And I was like, oh my goodness, I haven't eaten lunch. I'm starving. I've got to eat first. And so I threw open the refrigerator, and lo and behold, the only thing that was in my refrigerator was boiled eggs that my husband had made. And so I'm sitting there looking at this bowl of boiled eggs, and I'm thinking, oh, I can't eat that. And then another part of my brain is going, that's all there is to eat. And the other part of my brain is going, I want to eat that. And so I decided, you know what? I'm so tired of these food sensitivities. I want to eat that egg. I'm going to eat that egg. And so I grabbed a boiled egg, cracked it open. I took the first bite. And within literally 4 to 5 seconds, my eyes began to water. I began to sneeze uncontrollably. I sneezed probably 7 or 8 times in a row. All this mucus started coming out of my nose, and my eyes started to itch. And it was so extreme and so sudden. And I knew that I had been eating eggs my whole life. I had never had a reaction like this to eating eggs. Mm-hmm. And it was so obvious to me at that point in time that this was caused by the brain, and it was caused by my brain's fear that I was allergic to eggs, and therefore I had just put myself in a dangerous situation, and my brain was alerting me to that fact so that I would stop eating the egg and be safe. And so I took this opportunity to push back, and it was so frankly comical that I started laughing out loud, and sort of doubled over laughing at how crazy my brain was. And as soon as I started laughing, within a few seconds after that, all the symptoms went away. And I've been eating eggs since, and I love eggs.
It makes me think of, I was just talking to my wife about this a couple of days ago, but I'm sitting there slamming a cheese pizza as we're talking about this. Not right now, but not at 7:30 in the morning on the West Coast, but my wife and I were chatting about this, that right when this dairy thing started with me, I went and did food sensitivity testing. And it was strange because they did soy, wheat, milk, eggs, oat, and everything came back with no reaction, except for it said I had this strong allergy to oat, which was weird because I had been eating oatmeal up to that point with zero problems. And mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, well, I guess we're cutting out oat. I don't really know what's going on with the dairy thing. And mm-hmm. So I cut out oat. And I remember about a month later, because I was talking to it, she was an ENT doctor, but I did CrossFit with this ear, nose, and throat doctor. And she had said, like, you can grow out of food allergies too. So don't think that you can't have oat for the rest of your life. And I was like, yeah, you know what? And I like slam my fist down and I go home and I have some oatmeal, and my stomach, this had never happened before, and my stomach starts like breaking out, like in like itching, like really bad itching. And I was like, well, I can't touch this anymore. And of course, you know, I look back now and it's like, this is just so stupid. You know what I mean? And it just makes me think of the egg thing. That's wild. Yeah. I think the food stuff is tough. And I haven't heard a doctor say what you had said a little while ago, which is basically that you guys are taught like to not necessarily test for this stuff because of the rate of false positives is so high. And it makes me wonder about, you know, I've got friends that swear up and down they can't eat certain things. I mean, what in your estimate, I know this is going to be purely on anecdote or just sort of your generalized thought after all of these years of probably seeing people that have these crazy food sensitivities, you being one of them. What is the actual rate of people that have a perceived food sensitivity versus it's really something going on in their emotional world?
Oh, well, you know, outside of people, not including people who actually have celiac disease, I think it's over 90%.
Wow.
I've never had a patient come to me with this food sensitivity who wasn't able to get over it.
That is amazing. There's a particular listener, and I won't share her name, but I am going to message her once this airs, because she said she's down to 3 or 4 foods now that she can eat without causing some kind of a problem. And I was thinking, like, yeah, but you said you're in pain all the time, so really, like, even if that's all that you ate, it doesn't necessarily take away the problem. I think that's pretty darn profound. That's probably one of the bigger things that I think have come out of any of the interviews I've done with experts or professionals is that one thing. So, okay, so we have the egg story. That's obviously a big moment. But where did it happen? As I look at this list, it's like insomnia, generalized anxiety, Achilles tendonitis, chronomalacia, which, by the way, chronomalacia was my very first diagnosis ever. as a, like an 11-year-old kid playing Little League, suddenly I had this knee pain. TMJ, which my mom talks about having all the time. Your list also includes a lot of things my mom says that she has too, which is interesting. Tension, headaches, upper back, all this kind of stuff. So you've gone through the well in this. You're a practice, you know, you're a physician, and then you find that this is really rooted in your emotional world. Where did you find it? When did you find it? What was kind of the first thing that hit your mind once that happened? Did you have any skepticism? You know, kind of run us through when the corner turned and when you found out that, you know, maybe I don't have to be searching the rest of my life for a problem here, because the problem exists within me.
Sure. So my turn happened pretty abruptly and quickly. About 10 years into my chronic pain odyssey, I was in a very bad state. The last 2 years of it, I had developed severe anxiety and panic attacks, and that was just a whole nother world. I mean, dealing with the pain was bad enough, but when you add severe panic attacks, constant severe panic attacks on top of that, it was almost more than I could bear. And so one day I was just lying on my couch, was crying. I didn't know what to do. I felt like I was just running out of options. And I called up an old physical therapist I had had, and I just started crying. And I was like, do you have anything to offer me? And she said, Elisa, I don't know what's wrong with you, but I have another patient who had a miraculous recovery. Excuse me. Let me get some water here. Who had a miraculous recovery by going to this website. And I've never been to the website. I don't know what's on the website, but here's the name of it. You should try it. And the name of the website was unlearnyourpain.com. And that, of course, is Dr. Howard Schubner's website in Michigan, and who teaches people about TMS and is a great speaker and researcher in the field and author as well. And I almost didn't go to the website. I was just so exhausted, and I thought, I just can't get back on one more merry-go-round. But I dragged myself off the couch. I went to the computer, pulled up the website, and it is not an exaggeration to say that within 5 minutes, I absolutely knew this was what was wrong with me, and I had found the answer. And I immediately had hope that my healing was just around the corner. And it was just a sense of, immense gratitude and thankfulness that I had the answer. I never felt like embarrassed or I can't believe this happened, or it was just such great information to know that I had a diagnosis that was accurate and I had a path to recovery. So I was just very enthusiastic and immediately jumped on the recovery bandwagon.
So what were the I'm browsing the website right now, and of course I've been here before, but did you then go buy his book and go through his program, or what were the next steps for you?
Yeah. So, the next step was I called Dr. Schubner. He actually had his office telephone number on the website. And of course I expected to get a receptionist or administrator of some sort and leave a message. But, amazingly, he answered the phone and he talked to me for a few minutes, and I told him my story. And, he said very confidently, he said, I think you have TMS. I think you're going to get better. And he referred me to a pain psychologist. And I began chronic pain recovery right away. I did try to purchase his book, and I tried to start working it. But I had an experience that I have heard other people say that they've had too. Whenever I would read about TMS or about how to recover, I would immediately get a surge in anxiety. And so I couldn't actually read how to recover. I couldn't do any online programs. I couldn't follow any books. I really had to speak one-on-one with a person throughout my whole recovery.
What do you think that is? I feel like maybe I've heard that before too, but what is it about reading the literature on how to get better causes this uptick in anxiety? Because I know, like, Dr. Hanscom told me the first thing that he has his patients do is he has them bring in a spouse or significant other, whoever they're around the most, and say, look, this is the agreement between the two of you. There's no more talking about your pain. Like, that's over. That's the first thing that he requires. And I always thought that was so interesting. I find this very interesting too, in that people that are trying to get better, it almost becomes like a big roadblock. What do you think causes that? Like, why would that be?
Well, I think that's a great question, and I've wondered that myself. I was speaking with a colleague just last night about that specific thing. I don't know. Maybe one of the pain psychologists might have more insight into that. I don't know why reading about getting better would cause an increase in anxiety. I just don't know.
Did you work with one of the psychologists from the place in Beverly Hills? Did you do it remotely, or were they local to where you were?
Yes, I did. So I worked, they're called the Pain Psychology Center in LA.
Yep.
And I Skyped, coaching, I guess, is what they do, across state lines. Yeah.
Yeah, I interviewed Christy Weepy, who's the associate director there. We did an interview a few months ago, and her and I keep in pretty close contact. But I talked to Dan Lyman a little bit. I've talked to, there was somebody else, Valerie, something like that. I've sent emails back and forth with Alan Gordon. I think they're really doing amazing work there. They're actually doing a study right now that I think at this point is probably 5 or 6 months in at the University of Boulder. I think it's at the University of Boulder, but they're flying back and forth between LA and Boulder, Colorado. They're doing work with fMRIs, and it sounds like the preliminary results and all the clinical work is pretty promising on chronic pain recovery by using these kind of techniques. How long did you work with that TMS psychologist before? Well, actually, let's back up. How quickly did you start seeing big cessation of symptoms, and then how long before you basically didn't need that work anymore?
Right. So I think 2 months into therapy, I was probably getting therapy once every week in the beginning. And I would say 2 months into therapy, I started to notice a significant benefit. By 5, 6, 7 months, maybe, I was probably 80 to 90% better.
Yeah.
By a year out or a year and a half into therapy, I was pretty much done with my pain, but I still had a lot of fears. And so, I think there are layers to recovery for some people. Your pain can go away, but you can still have a lot of fears and automatic thoughts, chronic fear thoughts, negative thinking that can keep you in a state of heightened anxiety. And so there were layers of what I was trying to undo in my brain. By 2 years, I think I was training for my first triathlon.
Oh, that's awesome.
And that was a real milestone for me because I had always wanted to do one since I was in college, but what had stopped me was fear. And so this was a way for me to say, not only am I going to not be afraid anymore, but I'm going to show myself that my body's not broken, that I can actually do a triathlon. So I did that, that went really well. I finished first in my age group, which I was really proud of. And about a year and a half after that, I did a, they have these, I don't know if you're familiar with the Spring Classics in Belgium, and parts of France, the cycling classics, European cycling classics. They occur every spring, and the day before the race actually begins, tourists can come over and biking enthusiasts, and they can ride parts of the course or all of the course. And what's exciting about that is there were several miles of the course that was over cobblestones that went back to Napoleon's era. And it was really riding over cobblestones. I've never experienced anything like that in my life. And when I hit the cobblestones, I thought my head was going to fall off from the vibration.
Yeah.
I've never experienced that kind of vibration. And my first thought was, wow, this is weird. Like, I feel like my neck's about to snap off. And my next thought was, I can do this. I know I can do this. People do this all the time. I'm not going to hurt myself. And I finished the race and it was great. And so that was another big milestone for me of, you know, really not being afraid of physical experiences that your body is having.
I remember pushing my 2-year-old at the time across cobblestones in Scotland last year in a stroller. And yeah, it's not the same as like riding a bike on there, but I know exactly what you mean. I'm like, I just kept thinking like, why is all this stuff so old? Can't you repave this road? You know? What kind of exercises during this process of working with a psychologist was there? Because, you know, reading the material, there was sensitivity to that and it was causing an uptick in anxiety. But I'm curious, was it just almost like talk therapy, or were there certain things that they had you do? And if there were certain things that they had you do, did you ever get an uptick in anxiety from doing those?
Mm-hmm. Right. So a lot of the work I did in my recovery was sort of falls under the category of changing your relationship with the pain, and also changing how you treat yourself. Mm-hmm. So when I say changing my relationship with the pain, Alan Gordon teaches a concept called outcome independence, where you're not trying to, the goal is not to get rid of the pain anymore. The goal is to not let it bother you and to continue to live your life in a joyous way, acknowledging that the pain is there and accepting it, not resisting it, but also not letting it scare you or change your behavior. And so a lot of my recovery was learning to move without fear, to exercise without fear. When I would, if, for example, I was running for several days and I would get pain, I would just switch to swimming, and I'd swim for several days and then I might get a different pain. And then I'd switch to biking, and then I'd bike for several days. And so I kept moving at all cost. I wouldn't let it stop me from moving, but I might, if I didn't feel like I could get over that anxiety of that particular pain, I would just switch activities. And that worked really well for me. I think Sarno says, and you know, some people advocate just pushing through the pain. My anxiety level was so high that I just didn't feel like I could do that.
Yeah.
So I think there are different ways that people can go about this, can go about outcome independence. It doesn't have to be one way. I learned a lot about conditioned responses. Conditioned responses are when a neutral stimulus causes us to have real physical symptoms. And in this work, you eventually learn that, for example, it's not the running that is causing your knee pain. It is the belief that running will cause knee pain that is causing your knee pain. And once you realize that, it's just these very quick, under the radar, subconscious beliefs that are driving the triggering of your pain. Then you start to monitor those, be aware of them, and then you can change your thinking around that.
I think the whole thing is so fascinating, and there's so many different ideas on this stuff. It seems like, you know, and granted, a lot of Sarno's work was written, I mean, his third book was written in 1999, and his most popular was either early 90s or late 80s. And so some of those thoughts have obviously evolved over time. This has been studied now for a long time, and the people at the Pain Psychology Center and Howard Schubin are kind of at the leading pack of that, of those studies. Sarno seems so, a lot of his writings seem, I don't want to say like nonchalant, but he had talked about basically like knowledge therapy. I tell people what's going on and they get better. And it seemed just so, you know, so easy the way that he had described it. But, mm-hmm. you know, we find like, it seems like when it comes to the notion more so of like neural pathway pain, that maybe it's a lot more layered. And so I think sometimes like people sort of hope that they're going to be able to stumble on this one precipitating event or one specific thing that is causing their pain, or maybe one specific type of emotion. Talk about like, I guess, the difference in maybe that thought versus what you experienced. I mean, was there like an undertone of a particular emotion? Was it just a lot of fear of different things in general? Was it anger? You'd said rage very early in this interview. I'm curious, like, what are some of the emotions really that you unearthed? And could you attribute those to certain events or people or things?
Sure. Sarno, you know, was a big advocate of one, knowledge, psychoeducation about what is going on, and two, the role of rage in eliciting chronic pain. What I find in my practice when I'm working with chronic pain patients is that there are basically three components to recovery, and not everyone is going to need all three components. So some people are going to get better with solely psychoeducation, just learning that the brain can cause real physical symptoms, learning how the brain causes physical symptoms. And sometimes that's enough to just turn off the danger signal in their brain, and then they can just return to their life. I've had people who recovered in one session from years of back pain. So there are those people out there who don't have multiple layers of things to uncover. A larger group of people are going to need the psychoeducation and, in addition, cognitive behavioral tools and techniques to, as I said, learn to interact with their pain differently and learn to treat themselves better. So for those, you know, we'll go over self-compassion practices, stopping self-criticism, stopping self-pressure, learning about conditioned responses and practicing outcome independence or somatic tracking to break those conditioned responses. And then a third group will ultimately, to completely get rid of their symptoms, need some psychotherapy around working through repressed emotions, whether it be anger, sadness, guilt, or shame. So there are specific techniques around how to do that as well. So I think different people are going to, you know, will need different approaches. Everyone needs the psychoeducation. That's fundamental.
Yep.
I don't think you can recover from chronic pain without understanding how powerful your brain is and why it's actually creating pain in your life.
The self-pressure thing, I think, is always very interesting, because that is one, you know, as I've talked to hundreds of people over the last year, you know, some people that are completely over it and other ones that are not. I feel like overcoming self-pressure is a tough thing. You know what I mean? Like, if you're somebody that's used to succeeding, how can you really turn that part of you off? Seems really tough. Like, and I think that maybe that's why I've always hypothesized that there's certain professional athletes that I can point at. Tiger Woods is a good name. Andrew Luck is a good name, though he seems like he's kind of turning it around at this point. But it almost seems like that once one injury occurs, you know, they say that they twist an ankle or something in a game, and then maybe they come back too early, and then they don't perform as well as they're used to, or even as simple as like a college football player going from playing high level at a university to then going to the NFL or whatever it is and not playing quite as well, that they almost become snake bit, and then something is always in pain, and it almost seems like it's this constantly spinning circle. Like, there's an old quarterback, Vince Young, who played at the University of Texas, won the national title, you know, did all these amazing things, was the Madden cover athlete before he even stepped on the NFL field for the first time, goes on to play for the Titans, and then just his career just didn't seem like it was all that it should have been. And I remember this news story, this might have been 2007 or 2008, 2009 maybe, where ESPN was very non-responsible or irresponsible of them, but they had reported that he may have have tried to commit suicide. And I remember that story, which of course it didn't end up being true, or at least he had said that it didn't end up being true, which I feel like it's not ESPN's business anyway. But I always think, like, years back looking at that, like, maybe what happened is he, you know, his NFL career is not going as he thought it would. And so he ends up having essentially a panic attack, freaks out. ESPN, you know, ESPN talks about it in a certain way. But I feel like that's tough in certain professions or with certain people, sort of take that pressure off of yourself. I've heard Alan Gordon talk about this a lot in a lot of his videos. And it's still something that's even hard for me to grasp. Like, how can you remove that pressure? How does a doctor who's, you know, you have a very high pressure, very important job, probably one of the three or four most important jobs in the world, is treating people that have illness, injury, you know, whatever it is. Like, how do you reconcile that on putting less pressure on yourself?
Right. And I think that's a great question. So, you know, qualities, personality traits such as perfectionism, high achievers, wanting to help others, wanting to be good and liked, these are all great personality traits to have. And in fact, we need them if we're going to be successful in our fields. People who have these traits are reliable, they can be depended upon, they tend to have better jobs, they tend to get more raises, they tend to be praised more by their parents or by their colleagues or by their bosses. So these are good traits to have that are rewarded in our society. And that's not the problem. The problem is when you take these personality traits to the extreme and you turn them on the self. So the perfectionist ultimately can become highly self-critical of themselves and of others. The high achiever ultimately can put themselves under superhuman pressure. It's like when you ultimately achieve a goal that you've been working towards, people who put themselves under too much pressure don't stop and congratulate themselves and say, wow, I did a great job. They don't acknowledge that they succeeded at all. They just move the bar and try to reach a new goal. So it's never enough. And I think it may have been Alan Gordon describing it as being like a drill sergeant who is always telling you to do 5 more push-ups. And then it's never enough. It's just 5 more and 5 more and 5 more, and it never ends. And this pressure that people with chronic pain can put themselves under is like that. It's a pressure that never ends. It's a goal that you never reach because you're always moving the bar. So what I tell people is, you're not going to lose your perfectionism. You're not going to lose your desire to succeed, or to be a good person, or to want to help others. Those are all fundamental to who you are. But what you're going to lose is your lack of self-compassion in having these traits. So instead of telling yourself that it's never enough and that you're never good enough, that's what has to stop. You have to begin to give yourself positive messages of, I'm going to do the best I can. And, that was a great job. Way to go. You are good enough. You do this well. And so it's more of an orientation to the pressure, as opposed to ignoring the pressure. So, yeah, I still have, you know, when I work on projects, I want to do a good job. I want to reach my goals. But I don't put myself under this relentless criticism anymore, under this relentless pressure. I don't have the orientation anymore that nothing I do is ever good enough.
When I think back to sort of when everything kind of physically sort of fell apart for me, because it was like, you know, we talked about this before we got on, but it was kind of like I would have a sporadic symptom that would pop up every, you know, once every other year or something like that, except for the dairy thing stuck with me for a long time. But that series of a couple of months where things really got bad, and I had surgery and I did all that stuff. Like, basically I was in a sales job, which I'm still in a sales job. And 2012 I did pretty well. And then 13 better, you know, so I would be like 10th place, and then I would be like 7th place, and then 5th place, and then 3rd place. And then 2015, I became 1st place. But the problem with that, and I remember telling my wife like not too long ago, that was like a curse basically, because for me, I'm always like everything, like the next thing always has to be better than the previous thing. Like that was how I treated it. And so if you're 1st place in something, like the unrealistic expectation. So the next year I was like 14th place, which, you know, 14th out of 50 or whatever it was, still pretty good, right? Mm-hmm. But I remember thinking like, okay, but 14th is worse than 1st, and it's worse than what I was the year before, and worse than I was the year before, and I've set myself back 6 years and all this kind of stuff. Like, you know, this stuff that looking back now, I just kind of look at it and I'm like, you would never, like if a friend of yours came to you and said that, or your kid, if Zoe or Audrey, my two daughters, if they came to me and said the same kind of stuff 15 or 20 years from now, I would be like, no, like you're doing a good job. Like, but I think it's just tough for us to talk to ourselves like that.
Yeah, exactly. And, I believe, either Alan Gordon or Howard has always said, you know, you would never speak to your best friend like that, or you would never speak to a small child like that with unrelenting criticism and pressure. But this is how we treat ourselves. And I think if we can reorient towards approaching our life and our projects and our goals with joy, with enthusiasm, with more of a freer spirit, instead of coming from a place of pressure and fear of failure, then that allows the danger signal in the brain to turn off so that you actually have more energy, more concentration, more ability to think creatively in your projects, and actually things just get better all the way around than they ever were when you were putting yourselves under such negative types of pressure.
I think it's a great message. So in the last few minutes here as we wrap up, there's some I feel like it's two questions, but they're almost together. So firstly, I want to know, and I ask this of anybody that I've interviewed that is a physical domain practitioner, that could be an acupuncturist, could be a doctor, could be a physical therapist. Like I've interviewed a lot of different types of people. And so you have somebody come into your practice and they swear up and down that they have this physical problem. I guess, how do you reconcile the part of you that did all this schooling about physical modalities? And now, I mean, you yourself, you went, you know, you did the whack-a-mole thing. Like you bounced around from doctor to doctor thinking that there has to be something, like I have to be able to find something. You did myofascial release and physical therapy and all this kind of stuff. How do you reconcile a little bit, or how has it evolved a little bit in how you practice pre all of this stuff versus now?
Well, so currently I practice general psychiatry. So my patients who come to me are coming to me either for mental health conditions and who also have chronic pain but don't know that those two things are connected, or they're coming to me specifically for chronic pain and have already been through the entire process of multiple treatments, multiple doctors, multiple surgeries. So it's not... By the time usually they get to me, they're looking for something different. But for those for whom I'm introducing the concept for the first time, I find that people just want an answer. No one wants to be experiencing chronic pain, whether it's gastrointestinal or neurologic, whether it's headaches or stomach upset or foot pain. No one wants that, and they just want an answer. So I find that if you can just tell them the answer in a language that they can understand, using terms that are clear to them, they are very ready to accept most of the time. Now, some aren't, but I think the majority of people are able to accept that learned neural pathways in the brain can cause pain and real physical symptoms. You know, once you give them the example of... everyone, you know, gets embarrassed and their face might turn red, or they may have may be afraid of public speaking and get butterflies. Everyone knows what blushing is and everyone knows what butterflies are. These are fundamental concepts in our culture. But when you consider how do these things occur, what you fundamentally get is these are thoughts and emotions that are creating real physiologic changes in the body that are resulting in physical symptoms. And so once they understand that this is just how the brain works, this is a universal response to stress. This is our brain's way of keeping us safe. So once you normalize it and tell them that your brain's not broken and your body's not broken, what's wrong here is your brain is just getting the wrong signals. It's getting signals that you're in danger when you actually are not in danger. And all we have to do to recover is to turn off those signals, turn off those triggers that are activating the danger signal in your brain and thus the sympathetic nervous system. And then your brain, and then your pain just goes away.
To close this out, because I think like, I have to say, like, I think the people of Nashville are incredibly lucky to have you. So, tell me how this experience has made you a better doctor.
Yeah, it really has. When I was in residency, I remember a specific patient. I was in my third year of medical residency, and this was the year that the American Rheumatologic Association came out with the official diagnosis and criteria for fibromyalgia. And so this was a completely new thing. It had just occurred a couple of months before my seeing this patient. And of course, we didn't know how to treat it. No one knew how to treat it. And so the patient was ultimately referred to me, the psychiatrist, to see if we could help with something. And I remember sitting in my office and thinking, wow, how am I going to help this patient? I don't have anything to offer her. And I remember having this, in hindsight, what seems like a terrible thought, but in the moment, it was just an act, a thought of desperation to help her. But I remember thinking, I hope she's depressed because then at least I can give her an antidepressant. And sure enough, of course she was depressed because she was miserable because she had chronic pain and nobody could help her. But I also knew that even if I gave her an antidepressant, I knew it wouldn't take away her pain. And so I felt very helpless with this particular patient. And then fast forward about 5 years, when I was experiencing my symptoms and still seeing patients, and I had just started having arm pain, I remember a patient came to me and she had chronic pain. No one had been able to help her. And she said to me, she said, "Why, you know, what is wrong? Why can't you help me? You're a doctor." And I just said, and here I was having my own arm pain, which of course I wasn't revealing to her, but I was kind of wondering the same thing, you know, why can't I get help? And I just said to her, you know what? We are really not good at treating chronic pain right now, and I hope that changes in the future. So it was, the irony of all that was very interesting. Now I view a lot of illness through the lens of fear. And I look at the patient's childhood history, what's going on in their adult life, what traumas they've experienced, how they treat themselves. And to me, so much of what I see in my psychiatry practice, but also what primary care physicians are seeing in their practices, are due to this turning on of the danger signal in the brain, of the sympathetic nervous system being activated, of this chronic state of fear that individuals and our culture find itself in. So I now look through the lens of, is this patient experiencing levels of fear in their life? How are they treating themselves? What went on in their childhood? I take a much more thorough childhood trauma history. I ask what's going on in their life. How's your marriage? How are your other family relationships? What is your work like? What financial pressures are you under? Have you been assaulted? I ask a much more detailed, what we call a social history. most of the time that, you know, fully explains what the patient is experiencing physically in their body. And this is not a new idea. You know, this, the knowledge that emotions and stress could cause real physical symptoms has been around since Hippocrates. More recently, in the 1920s, there was a very famous physician. I believe her name was Dr. Francis, but honestly, I've forgotten right now. But she was well-renowned as a medical student educator, well-respected. And I read a speech of hers that she had given to a class. And it said, basically, you have to know the environment that this person lives in. You have to know where they come from. You have to know what is going on in their life right now in order to understand why they are here in the hospital.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding. I think that's great. I think that's a really good way of explaining it. Dr. Batson, thank you so much. We just hit an hour, which is a little bit more than, than I promised, but I feel like, everything in here has merit. I think that a ton of people are, there's definitely new things in here that haven't been talked about since this show started. So, where can people find you? You know, tell us about your website and, you know, best way for, like, if you're local to the area, what's the best way to get an appointment with you? If somebody feels inspired by listening to this and wants to come see you.
Sure. So, in order to, make an appointment with me, you can go to my website, which is www.alisabatsonmd.com. And on the contact page will be a telephone number. You can also email me from that page. But the telephone number and the name associated with the telephone number will be my scheduler. And I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. You can usually get an appointment within the month. And I see people for an hour, and they may reschedule, they may not. I often refer them to online and print resources. I have people come from out of state. I have people fly in from out of state and then schedule multiple appointments back to back on successive days to get a lot of information in at once. So, depending on the patient, I approach it. I can approach it in many different ways. But yeah,
awesome. So
thank you, Eddie. I appreciate your interest in this and for continuing to spread the good word about what causes chronic pain.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you, Dr. Batson.
Thank you.